Bienvenidos a la rueda de prensa de The Cycling Podcast en este segundo día de descanso de la Vuelta a España en Santillana del Mar. Por favor, preguntas solo en inglés. Questions only in English, please.
Hey guys, how are you? This is Sergio from Spain. So, firstly, I'd like to congratulate you because of your awesome podcast. Also, I'm a journalist and I write for a cycling magazine, Planeta Ciclismo, here in my country. And for sure, I listen to you almost on a daily basis. So, I'd like to talk about Valverde, Alejandro Valverde. I think he can win it, win the world again, 9 years since his first and the only victory in 2009, but he should be smarter, I mean, in the sense that he's stronger than Quintana, but he keeps riding for him, you know. And Valverde has, from my point of view, two problems. The first one is that he keeps thinking of the world, for sure. He's a real candidate, but maybe he should focus. Because we are about to start the third week in the Vuelta and he has a big real option of winning it. Maybe he should focus firstly the Vuelta right now and try to forget a bit about the walls, but for sure later, once the Vuelta finishes, he should and he has to focus on in the walls because he deserves it. I mean, he has a rainbow jersey in his legs. He has been quite near for many years, getting some bronze or silver medals, and maybe this year is his chance. So I think he deserves it. He is stronger than Nairo and even stronger than Simon Yates as well. If he can solve that problem between inside the team, also maybe the manager. So Inzue should consider Valverde or should say publicly that Valverde is the real leader. Maybe all the problems could search and maybe Valverde could focus on getting the leadership of the team and try to get firstly the Vuelta and secondly, hopefully, the Worlds. Nothing else. Thanks for listening and I keep listening to you guys. Cheers.
Well, I know Sergio and I know his magazine, Planeta Ciclismo. This month on their latest issue, currently on sale, they have a cracking interview with Carlos Sastre, second part of a two-part interview, where he basically describes the management of his latest teams. And it's quite funny, you know, to see how he despises them. But yeah, it's a good thing when you are out of cycling and you don't need to keep any respect or any face between the people who is still currently this business, currently running this business. As for the question...
Valverde. He would not be the oldest ever winner of the Vuelta, would he?
No, I think he wouldn't, but to be honest, I don't have a...
Chris Horner.
Remember who was it in the 50s, in the 40s?
He was 41 when he won the Vuelta in 2013, but the record that he beat was Firmin Lambot. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name correctly. It's not a rider I remember, but he won the Tour de France in 1922 at 36. Wow. So it's extremely rare for someone in their late 30s to even be contending, and Valverde's 38. But we talked about this briefly last night. He's there. And he looks pretty strong. He'll probably go quite well in the time trial tomorrow. Yeah. Can he win this race?
Well, Eusebio Unzues said something quite interesting and also quite spot on, in my opinion, when I asked him about the fact that Valverde was not preparing himself anymore for the Innsbruck Worlds, but racing for victory in this Vuelta. He told me that, as for the moment, he was in contention, and there was no reason to get himself out of contention when there is only 1 week to go, and he is, what, second in the GC? He can well be the leader of the race tomorrow. He can well get the leader's jersey in the time trial of Torre la Vega. And from then on, it will be a matter of him contending as a favorite, you know, as a straight-on favorite. Today, this morning, in the Movistar team's press conference, there was this question, quite interesting. What would happen if Valverde took the red jersey? Would Nairo become his helper? And the question was asked to Nairo, and he began hesitating of what to say, and then Valverde jumped in and solved the question. He said that even if he took the red jersey, there is no question, Nairo is the leader, and he wouldn't have to ride for him. They would still be co-leaders, or he would just, or Valverde would be his domestic. But I also want to make a point. I think a second Vuelta a España wouldn't add anything to the Alejandro Valverde palmarès from a historical point of view, whereas the rainbow jersey would be the icing on the cake. And that's really, in my opinion, the prize that would showcase better,
however,
Alejandro Valverde's possibilities.
He could win both.
You think that after going deep for another 3 straight weeks, after the 3 weeks of Tour de France, he will have the power, the kick necessary to win Innsbruck?
So you think it might almost help him to fall out of contention a little bit, and so that he can maybe not go quite so deep for the final week, and especially in those final stages in Andorra, perhaps?
Yeah, I think so. I think that he, if the goal was to win the rainbow jersey, it would have been beneficial not to ride himself deep in the previous mountaintop finishes, just because all the bullets that he is spending now, he won't have them in Austria. But you know, every rider, every person is a different world, and there are some type of riders that don't feel like saving energy. That doesn't help them, and Valverde is one of these breed. So if he is going to spend psychological energy by trying to save physical energy, it's good that he goes for both. And if he falls short in the two goals he has, it will be unfortunate, but still, if he's loyal to himself, that's all he needs to be happy.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Okay, I've been joined by Daniel Freeb, or rather, I have joined Daniel Freeb because Daniel refused to come to my hotel. He said, it's my rest day. I want sunshine, cold beer, and prime real estate.
That's true. I stand by that.
Well, clearly, because here I am.
Not only is it my rest day, it's my rest 3 hours, because I've been working most of the day. I managed to sneak in a run. I can't afford to be flouncing around looking for sort of out of town 2-star hotels. You know, I don't know where you stay, Rich.
It's quite a nice hotel. Oh, okay. Quite a nice hotel.
It's a beautiful town, this Santillana del Mar, isn't it? A
couple of podcast listeners in my hotel, actually, two gentlemen from Cork, who I think it's Keith and Ray. I'm just going to look up their names. But they got the boat over from Cork. 32 hours, I think it was.
Didn't they spot you earlier as well?
That's what I mean. They came and said hello, which was very, very nice. Ray and Keith. So they were trying to get better Wi-Fi signal outside the hotel, downloading cycling podcasts. Great to hear. Thanks for saying hello, and it was nice to meet you. Hope you enjoy the Vuelta, chaps. Daniel, first question from Stuart Heseltine.
Hi, chaps. It's Stuart Heseltine from Adelaide in South Australia. Really enjoy the broadcast, chaps. Excellent company on long drives interstate. My question's for Daniel, and I'm particularly interested in his recent football analogies. He describes Team Sky as playing ticky-tack football, and only earlier this week as Mitchelton Scott as a sit-back and counter side. My question is, which team best epitomises the hoof it up the field to the centre-forward approach? Thanks.
Well, this is relatively easy in the sense that, so who hoofed up the field to the centre forward?
Route one.
Well, that implies no real build-up, no real coherent plan, just fire a guy down the road and hope for the
I've
best.
I've got a suggestion.
And, well, I would say it's probably direct energy.
Lotta Sudal, I think, as well.
Possibly.
Tim Wellens, he's route one, isn't he?
Yeah, it's possibly, although they also have... races where they're working for, or they have been working for Andre Greipel, and also GC guys as well.
But Andre Greipel's like a big centre forward, isn't he? A big old fashioned centre forward.
I suppose so. But it's very that hoofed up the field very much sums up the way a lot of French teams have ridden over the past few years, I would say.
Okay, the next question is from Steve, and this is certainly one for Daniel.
Hi, it's Steve here from Bromley. I've been a friend of the podcast for the past 2 years. Your coverage of the sport regularly takes you all across Europe to all sorts of countries and remote regions, conversing with people, all different nationalities, multiple languages. And I fondly remember the tragically short-lived feature earlier this year on the Giro, Lionel Learns Italian. I've started trying to learn a bit of Spanish this year, been tired of being the ignorant Brit abroad, not speaking the lingo. And so I've been trying to pick up that language. My question is, do you have any helpful tips on the best way to learn and get by in a new language, or indeed tips on what not to do? And as a cheeky follow-up, how many languages can you each speak and get by in on your travels? I believe TV's Daniel Freeb is a bit of a polyglot. Keep up the good work and buenos dias.
Well, definitely a question for you, Daniel. First of all, how many languages do you speak?
Five to a...
Let's run through them. French.
French, Italian, Spanish, English, and German.
Yeah, not bad. How about Dutch? You can get by in Dutch.
I understand Dutch. I understand. I can read Dutch. I can read Portuguese and a couple of others, but I can't really speak them.
Almost as impressive as Pavel Sivakov, who we heard from on the podcast the other day.
How does he speak?
Well, he speaks Russian at home. He speaks French, English. He was born in Italy.
Speak Italian, no. Because he didn't spend much time in Italy, did he?
No.
Tips to... Well, I think that you have to throw yourself into it. You have to set your bar... I always think you have to set your bar very high. You have to aspire to complete fluency in a language and not just hope to get by. I think only by setting your bar very high will you... speak... And write with the degree of kind of bluster or self-confidence that you need. I think you have to, unfortunately, you have to try to lose and shed all of your self-consciousness, which is very difficult. But it really is, it's an exercise in acting. You're really impersonating someone who speaks that language. And after that, beyond that, people learn in different ways. I mean, I always learned, and I still sort of learn in a very sort of written, centric kind of way. I like to know grammar kind of inside out, or try to. Whereas other people, for other people, it's a lot more verbal. Rich?
It's interesting that you say that it's about impersonation. It's also about your ear. And one thing I would say is you're very good at impersonations, and you've clearly got a good ear for the way that people speak, and you're able to pick that up. And that, I think, is a key thing too.
But it's very, motivation is absolutely key, as it is with everything. And I think that there has to be a great degree of curiosity, and there has to be, a kind of bloody-mindedness about you and about the way you go about it. Because there are an awful lot of, there are an awful lot of knocks along the way. You get your confidence undermined a lot. People early on in the process, people don't understand you, or people sort of will turn their nose up or kind of sneer at you trying to speak a language, but you just have to batter through it, really.
And I can speak French okay. I can get by, but my written French and my ability to read it is much better than my ability to speak it. I do have that self-consciousness, I think, when I try to speak a lot of the time. And over, my wife is French, I spend time with my in-laws, and over the course of a few days, it becomes much better. But it's not something I find easy. I remember when I became a journalist, there were older journalists I encountered who knew how to ask for a receipt in about 15 different languages. Those days of journalism have gone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, you know, Lionel and I can certainly ask for a beer, a coffee, you know, all the essentials in Italian, Spanish and French.
Yeah. And it is very hard work. I mean, it's, particularly as you get older, it's also rust collects very quickly, even when you do speak languages quite well. You don't practice them within the space of a month or 2 months. The rust will begin to collect and you'll notice it. Another thing that people don't realise and acknowledge is fatigue. You know, you're exercising muscles with you, which you are not used to using when you speak in foreign languages. And often you have the experience where you go somewhere and first day you speak very well, second day you speak quite well, and then the third and fourth and fifth day you speak less well because you're getting tired.
Is your personality different in different languages?
Yeah, I think it is.
Is it better?
I think I'm a lot more exuberant in Italian, for example.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Hi chaps, it's Michael Thompson here. I'm referring to correspondence that I had with Lionel during last week after your Stage 6 show, in which I thought there were some fairly controversial statements made, particularly by Daniel, with regard to defending Nasser Bohani's long record of bad behavior. So first of all, I completely agree that Bohani was more than likely guilty of nothing more than just another sticky bottle incident, which is certainly nothing that is isolated to just him. I think a lot of riders have been guilty of that, as we know, and sometimes habitually so. And I totally agree that Bohani was very unfairly reported upon in the media, where they claimed that he had hit his team car and lost his temper. But I can understand that you know, that would have upset him, and it wasn't necessarily truthful at all as far as it was reported. But really what upset me was Daniel saying that Bohani, while he does have a long record of violent incidents basically against members of the public and other riders, and he has got a well-known bad temper, to the extent that I believe Cofidis has employed his father to pacify him as an official team member. Not even sure if that's true, but it is what I've read in the media. But either way, you know, it just seems to me that Bohani keeps on getting excuses made for him, not just by the media, who clearly seem to love him for something, other than his sprinting talent, but also by the race commissaires. I mean, he gets the lightest punishments, the lightest sanctions of any rider, as far as I'm concerned. And let's just compare him and Moscon. I mean, I'm no fan of Moscon. I think violent behavior and repetitive violent behavior has no place in the peloton, no place in the sport at all. It's cycling really needs to try in every way possible to retain its purity and its integrity and its image as an honorable team pursuit. But, you know, Moscon, for example, threw a punch at someone. I'm not sure if it connected during the Tour de France. And he was immediately ejected from the race. People were calling for Sky to sack him. And if they weren't calling for Sky to sack him, they were certainly saying that they'd be very surprised if he didn't get sacked. And yet, when Bohani does similar things in last year's Tour de France, he did pretty much exactly the same thing. He just got a 1 minute penalty, and I think it was a 200 franc fine. A 1 minute penalty for a sprinter means nothing. So effectively, he got champagne money for one evening, if that, you know, sanctioned against him. And another thing that came up in the episode was that it was mentioned, which I felt very uncomfortable with, it was mentioned that Bohani it comes from a very minority background of North Africans in the peloton. There are very, very few of them. And Daniel made mention of the fact that because he comes from a minority background, who knows what I think this was the wording, was who knows what effect that had on him. I understood that to be, you know, justifying his violent behavior and his aggressive behavior. I don't see how that's possible, that your minority background can mean that, you know, that it's A, that you would commit more violent acts, and B, that that would be okay because, you know, who knows what you've been through. You know, the same rules must apply to everybody. I also sent a number of links through with, you know, other instances where he's been called out for basically getting very, very light fines and very light punishments in the past. And I'm not saying he's the only rider who gets light fines, but it just seems to be a trend. And I don't know why everyone protects him so much, because, yes, he's a fantastic sprinter. Not the best sprinter in the world by far, even though, but he is a very good sprinter. But I don't know why he gets such special treatment, and everyone seems to make excuses for him when someone like Moscon, for example, gets the harshest possible treatment for exactly the same transgressions. Anyway, thank you so much for the fantastic coverage of the Vuelta and for all the other friend specials and kilometer zeros that you do. I really appreciate it, and keep up the good work.
Quite a question there from Michael Thompson, Johannesburg. I wasn't here. I wasn't on that podcast, Daniel, so I have to hand it over to you, I'm afraid.
Well, it's tricky, Rich. Did I defend him? I'm not sure. I suppose I try to give a balanced perspective. To be clear, I would say that as a team manager, I wouldn't sign Nasser Bouhanni, partly because of his disciplinary record and partly because of his failure to learn from his mistakes. And, you know, he's not a kid anymore. This is not his first or his second year as a professional. And the parallel with Moscon that Michael mentions, I think that there is an argument that some allowance could have been made, certainly up until maybe last year, for Moscon because of his youth. That's not the case with Bouhanni, and he should have learned by now. I'm not sure I agree that he's always been lightly sanctioned. You know, he's lost big races, he's lost the Hamburg's Cycle Classics because of, a transgression that was pretty marginal, I would say. It could have gone either way. But I think he has benefited possibly from the fact that he does have this kind of difference, this edge, partly to do with his background, partly to do with his general, the kind of spikiness that he conveys. He has benefited from that. I mean, his salary from Cofidis, the first deal he signed with Cofidis was huge. It was about 1.4 million euros, and even the second one he signed was pretty huge. I think it was more or less the same amount of money, and he's not delivered. As a man, however, I mean, that's my evaluation of him as someone who is looking to sign him or not sign him. As a man, however, I would say that it's disappointing that he hasn't learned from his mistakes. But, you know, it takes some people longer than others. And hopefully he will eventually learn. And, you know, from the interaction, fairly limited interaction I have with him, I'm not ready to write him off completely, because I think there are good qualities there. I think there is an engaging side of him. There's a real side of him. There's a modesty about him, which I do find quite endearing. And, you know, there are other riders in the peloton that I think are very sort of polished and even contrived, and they are celebrated perhaps too much, when Bouhanni does have this a degree of authenticity about him. He's true to himself.
Moscon, I mean, there's a degree of authenticity about Moscon as well. You could say he's unpolished. He's, you know, but I think the thing with Moscon is that the initial transgression, the racism allegation, is so beyond the pale, and there's so little diversity in the peloton that for Moscon to racially abuse one of the very few black riders in the peloton, it showed him in a particularly bad light, and you felt that, you know, other sports that have dealt effectively with racism have done so by coming down really hard on the perpetrators of racism, basically, and so that everything else that's happened with Moscon since then has kind of been seen in that context to some extent, fairly or not. And, you know, the transgressions have varied in terms of their severity. You know, I would say at the tour, lashing out Elie Jesper the way he did, it's probably not one of the more serious ones. And yet it was the one for which he's been most severely punished in a way. Well, it is the one for which he's been most
by
severely
the UCI.
Punished. Yeah.
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 He wasn't punished at all by Sky, really, was he?
No. Wow. No. No, he wasn't.
And as I said, I think a couple of weeks ago, one of the fundamental issues, the difficulties with that, the most recent incident, was that people were demanding, calling for him to be sacked. And in professional cycling, there's no transfer system. And, you know, we do see examples where football clubs, for example, wash their hands of a player when he transgresses numerous times. But it's not that noble a gesture, because they're usually cashing, you know, 10 or 15 million pounds or euros or whatever for the trouble of someone else taking that player off their hands. In Sky's case, they stood to lose a rider who is a real asset. And what effectively had happened to Moscon at the Tour de France is that he got a red card. It was no more than that, really, if you take away the precedence.
Hi, guys. It's KP calling from California. I just want to let you know you're smashing it all year long. The podcast is fantastic. Two questions about the Peloton. When a team is controlling the Peloton, is the dynamic limited to speeding up the Peloton? Or can they possibly slow it down through active means other than not participating in taking a turn to pull? That's one question. Second one being, what's the minimum size a breakaway would have to be to stay away from the Peloton, to be able to create that momentum together that they're just as fast as the Peloton is? And, you know, at what size is it diminishing returns? You know, 50? 75, 100. Anyway, appreciate your support. Thanks.
Thanks, KP. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't know if you heard our interview with Theo Gegenhart on Sunday up at the top of Lagos de Covadonga. And he was in the breakaway on Sunday and said, ultimately, it was up to the peloton whether or not they stayed away. That's kind of obvious. But it's sort of immaterial how fast the breakaway goes. The peloton will ride accordingly, and they'll ride to the kind of gap they want to give the breakaway, how much rope they want to give them. And then it's a matter of calculation about, you know, they're always keeping an eye on what that gap is and how long it will take them to close it. And occasionally they make a mistake, but not that often. But the peloton is really controlling the whole race, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that there are riders in particular who, if they get in a breakaway, they can make it, and if they're with other riders of a similar caliber in a breakaway, they make it very hard for the peloton or whichever team has decided or on that particular day to take responsibility or has needed to take responsibility to control the peloton. And the harder they make it for that team, the more likely it is that when it's crunch time, whether it's 30 kilometers to go, 20 kilometers to go, and the team or the riders who have been controlling the peloton for most of the day, they look around for and they need more help because it's been a hard day. It's more likely then that they don't receive any help. You know, other guys say, well, we're tired as well, we're not going to do anything, and then the breakaway probably, you know, has a decent chance of staying away. So, you know, it does help if there are stronger, it helps the breakaway's chances of staying away if there are stronger riders and faster riders at the front. But really, the majority of the time nowadays, when the break does stay away, it's because of an error or because they have been allowed to, they've been given license very early in the stage. The decision has been made, kind of a collective decision en masse by the peloton quite early, that they're not going to take them back, or a mistake has been made, but that happens not very often, does it?
A phenomenon this year which a lot of people have commented on is that breaks have been allowed less leeway, less of a gap. They've kept them certainly below 10 minutes. This Vuelta has been a bit different, but the Tour, well, breaks weren't really getting more than 3 or 4 minutes. They were keeping them on a fairly tight leash. And I guess what's happened there is teams have looked at the effort of, you know, sprint teams in particular, looked at the effort required to allow a break to get a big lead and then close it, or just keep it a little bit more constant all day. And I guess the effort to do that is less overall than the kind of slow, fast pattern that we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
Somebody clever will have looked at that and said, rather than give them 10 minutes and then chase really hard, just chase a little bit harder all day. And it's a more constant, consistent effort.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible that with the 9-man teams, particularly in major tours, and the 8-man teams in smaller races, there was a sort of designated rider, kind of breakaway killer. We saw last year's Tour de France, 2017 Tour de France, Julien Vermont do it a lot for Quickstep. And he was one guy who was really only there for that, and he was almost wasted in that role. He couldn't do anything else because it consumes too much energy to do that role. And as the teams have got smaller, you know, as we keep saying, teams can't afford riders who can only do one thing. So what's the solution to that? Well, maybe it's to make sure the break doesn't go far enough or so far that you need a guy who consumes all of his energy just controlling it all day. It's better to just keep it 3 minutes so that then that particular guy can also be useful in the finale as well.
Hi guys, Thomas from Norwich here. My question to you is, with all the chat the other day about how good it is to see certain riders keeping the gel wrappers with them throughout the stage, why can't the UCI do more to find riders who throw away their rubbish at the side of the road? I was watching the stage today and saw Superman Lopez just throwing a can of Coke to the side of the road. With all the fines that are handed out for improper feeding and everything else, it seems amazing that the UCI can't fine riders for littering at the side of the road.
Well, Daniel, as a man of nature, this is right up your street, but perhaps you'd like to correct Thomas's pronunciation of Superman.
Superman Lopez. I absolutely agree with Thomas, 100%. Find them.
Your car is like a recycling vehicle at the moment, isn't it? It's like
we didn't throw anything away.
No.
I absolutely chastised my cameraman and travelling companion Scott the other day because I saw him just put a plastic bottle in a normal bin. I was disgusted.
So you just your car is just full of plastic bottles. What are you gonna do with them all?
Well, recycle them, obviously.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, it does set a terrible, it's a terrible thing to see riders just throwing.
I saw Valverde chucking a bidon down a
Fran made the point of the day that bidons, most of them will be picked up by fans.
Yeah, was it a bidon? He chucked something, but it went right down the mountain. It was just going to lie there for years, I think.
Yeah. It's not great. I don't know what the solution is to the bidons issue, but certainly little wrappers, as Luis Angel Matte pointed out to us, they don't weigh anything, you know. It's not going to really cost a rider anything in terms of watts or energy to carry their wrappers to the finish. So we encourage them to do so, and I'm sure our sponsor, Science and Sport, certainly encourages people to take the wrappers with them.
There's an awful lot to be done in professional cycling on environmental impact. You know, team buses have their motors on all day, their engines on all day because of it's the air conditioning, isn't it, in the bus. They're just parked up with their engines on, which is not good, is it?
No, it's not the most environmentally friendly sport, ironically enough, but it's perhaps the next frontier, the next thing that the UCI should really look at. I'm sure they will. Well, am I? I don't know. I hope they will. We should leave it there, Daniel. Well, let's go and have some dinner, shall we?
We will.
Some environmentally friendly dinner.